Welcome to Designing Hollywood Podcast in association with the John Campia Show. I'm your host, Philip Boutte Jr. Designing Hollywood Podcast Show is dedicated to all things movies and its industry's professionals. Today's episode is sponsored by Eastern Costume, and today's guest is an American costume designer known for her work on Mank, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Hunger Games Catching Fire, Gone Girl, and Red Sparrow. She won the Costume Designer of the Year at the 2013 Style Awards for her work on The Hunger Games Catching Fire, and she's been recognized by her peers at the Costume Design Guild Awards by being nominated on 3 separate occasions and winning 2 times on behalf of her work on The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and The Hunger Games Catching Fire. She designed capsule collections inspired by both films for H&M and Net-a-Porter, respectfully, which were met with huge commercial success and both sold out in record time. Previously, she costume designed David Fincher's Mank, for which she was nominated for a 2021 Academy Award, a BAFTA Film Award, Critics' Choice Award, and the Costume Designers Guild Award, among many other accolades. The film starred Gary Oldman, Amanda Seyfried, Lily Collins, and Charles Dance, among others, and launched Netflix on December 4th, 2022. In television, she costume designed the pilot episode for Westworld and was nominated for an Emmy and Costume Designers Guild Award as a result. She also costume designed the pilot episode for Ray Donovan and the first season of C for Apple TV, starring Alfre Woodard, Sylvia Hoeks, and Jason Momoa. She is a frequent collaborator with directors David Fincher and Francis Lawrence and has worked with directors Jonathan Nolan and Joel Egerton, among others. She is a graduate of FITM and attended both the Los Angeles and San Francisco campuses. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome my friend and one of my favorite people in life, costume designer Trish Somerville, to the Designing Hollywood Show. Boy, that was a handful. But as our audience, as our audience will be able to see, we wanted to make sure that they know just about how much you've accomplished, and she's accomplished so many more things. So I want to get into kind of thought process with you a little bit, just which is the boring stuff, which is, what moment in time do you remember thinking that this is what you wanted to do?
Oof. Well, early on, I knew I wanted to do fashion and do clothing. I didn't really know what we do existed at the time. So I went to FITM for fashion design, thinking I'd do, you know, women's ready to wear clothing, and then got into doing music videos. And from doing music videos, kind of got into doing commercials, and then saw there's this whole other world of film. And so probably then, it was definitely after college, realizing like there is this other career that I could have that I was really unaware of. And it was really interesting to me because, you know, like going from doing music videos and helping try and tell those stories, it was telling, you know, longer stories, more detailed stories, character-driven stories. And I realized that's what I really wanted to be a part of. I love being a part of this tribe of people that want to do creative things together whilst telling a story.
And do you feel as though, like, when doing that now, do you feel like it's kind of combined all of the things that you love together, like in terms of every step along the way?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, I mean, you and I, you know, we've had a friendship and a work relationship for quite a long time. You were actually one of the first illustrators I'd worked with. You know, on Dragon Tattoo, I just had an illustrator work with me on one character and oddly like one sketch. And then and then with Catching Fire was the first time I really had an illustrator in house with me working. And as you saw, it's like this thing of, you know, I love bringing together people and I love bringing together, you know, research. I love research and I love, you know, different cultures around the world. And I love fabrics and I love doing draping. And so, yeah, I think with like filmmaking and even, you know, in TV as well with these projects, it's, I'm able to bring all the things I love definitely together, you know, and try new things and experiment with new things and bring in new techniques and meet all different types of people. I mean, that's one of the great advantages of our business is, you know, with our work, we get to constantly meet new people and see how people do things differently and learn from them.
Which has been a real joy. Speaking to my experiences with Trish is especially I know for her crews in terms of like bringing people together. A Trish crew is a happy crew. And what I mean by that is everyone's all together and working, but it comes from the top. I personally have worked with a lot of different designers, and I think Trish is the only one that I personally can remember where I felt like I had known you forever. And I was like, she's literally going to be my best friend.
Oh, that's so sweet.
It's a spreading thing, though, that I know a lot of people feel the same way about you in terms of just like kind of growing. And I think that that's probably because of what the experience that you just talked about. You've done so many different jobs and kind of come up in the industry in a way to where you have kind of formed them together, that I really feel like when people are working with you, they feel like you understand their job. You understand them as an artist. So I think that that's a really good testament to that. I wanted to find out, just because of that, we were talking about inspiration, right? And like in terms of like the things you're pulling from, your films inspire a lot of people, but what inspires you? Like, what are the things that you're personally inspired by?
Well, I do also have to make a comment about you give these really nice compliments and then you continue to talk. So I can't thank you and say how great it is to work with you and like how grateful I am for, you know, the teams of people I do get to work for. I am really, really grateful because I'm somebody who works extremely hard and I somehow end up on very challenging projects for a lot of reasons and all over the world. And I really appreciate it. A lot of the crew I have works equally as hard and is really committed and really cares. So I have to say thank you to all the people I've worked with, you know, along my way. Because it's, you know, I can't do it by myself. So I think far as things that that inspire me, I'm really inspired by other cultures, you know, a lot of, you know, what's happening around the world, within the United States, outside the United States, definitely. I'm really inspired by, you know, how textiles are made. I'm inspired by artists. You know, it's many, many things. I'm really inspired by wildlife and the insect world. You know, it's various things like that, especially when I'm looking at color or textures or patterns. I mean, definitely I'm inspired so much by nature. But yeah, I mean, I'm really inspired daily by people. I observe a lot of things in my environment, outside of my environment, in every walk of life. And I love to be, you know, I think that's part of what's great with traveling with work is I get to go and be a minority in a different place and learn culturally what other people do and how they do things. And, you know, and at times it's a struggle, you know, and sometimes it's like, you know, it's this big shift of how you try and assimilate. And I realized at one point, like a lot of people tell me that my accent, what accent, where are you from? And I don't think I have an accent ever, but I think it's because I travel so much. And then with my team of people, it's all local people. So I start to pick up these accents or the way they speak. And I think it's this kind of animal instinct of assimilation and trying to fit in, you know? So I think for me, I'd have to say mainly it's probably just people, you know, people inspire me in different ways of, I'm fascinated by, you know, with how people put things together. When I did Dragon Tattoo and we were doing these kind of these reads with the various young women that were reading, we would do like read, you know, six women at a time. And then they were going to do this chemistry read with Daniel Craig. In each one's room, I put all the kind of same articles of clothing and accessories. And I wanted to see how each actress put it on themselves and how they came out. And it gave me a lot of clues as to how that person was going to move and what they were going to do and kind of what their mannerisms would be like and how connected they were to the Lisbeth Salander character. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'm really fascinated with like human behavior and cultures.
Do you read? Well, I know the answer to the question. Do you read? You seem to me to read a lot. Do you find that that's something that really informs you as well as just reading about things?
Definitely. I mean, I probably read a bit less than when you and I first met. I mean, I was, you know, we both had that joke about like, I was like, check out this book and check out this book. And I really do. I mean, I read a lot in different ways. I mean, I still read like the news, you know, on days when I can handle what the news is. I have a lot of books. I really love having an actual book to go through and look at, whether it's a photography book or, you know, it's fiction or nonfiction. I do love the idea of storytelling, you know, and I am really inspired by that. And, you know, my wife's an actor. And so like, you know, watching how she's inspired by things that she reads and like, you know, like even like historical facts and contemporary facts and very intrigued by other people's lives and, you know, how people lived so long ago and how they live contemporary and, you know, what everybody's daily struggles are and what are ups and downs in people's lives. And I think it helps you have this connection about reading. I mean, it's this, you can create whatever you want in your head, you know, and I think that's the great part about scripts or about reading books is we all see characters differently. We all see stories differently. But I was talking to some friends yesterday and I said, there's this really beautiful thing about good storytelling, you know, touches everyone. It doesn't have to be, you know, if it's a story about an African family, like if it's great storytelling, I can feel so moved and touched and I can visualize the whole thing. I don't have to be, you know, living in that community to totally understand that, but it will give me interest of like, I want to know more about this community. I want to know more about these people. So I think, yeah, I just really enjoy great storytelling, whether it's in a script or it's in a book, you know.
Something you just brought up that actually I think is a good trait for you, but also I think helps you with design is empathy. I think that designing with empathy and actually being able to emote or relate to people, regardless of background or, you know, or creed or whatever it is, and still be able to feel what the people feel. I think that that's a good testament for costume design in terms of just storytelling, right? And character design, right? Thinking about stuff. So that's something that do you find that when you are kind of placing yourself within the world of the story that you have to kind of emote or empathize with the characters to a degree in order to design them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have to, for me personally, I have to have some connection to the story. And there's projects where it's harder than other projects to find a connection or to a particular character to find that connection. And, you know, I think that's what is really great because you can, you know, I've had projects where there is that evil, you know, that evil person and that bad person. And, you know, one example was, you know, with, On Catching Fire, you know, with Donald Sutherland, it was talking about President Snow and my first meeting with him, and I was showing him tears that I had, and it was dictators, you know, and evil people, and Hitler and Mussolini, and you know, one of the popes, and you know, so it was a lot of people that I considered, you know, had this really evil ways about them, and being a dictator and being a ruler and a controller and not being compassionate. And so in that, like showing it to him, you know, he laughed and he said, "So you think I'm bad?" And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "I try and think there's good and bad in everyone, and it's just what brings it out and which path we choose to take. And every day is different." But it is like with that, like I had to find redeeming things about his character and how he saw himself, how Snow saw himself, to be able to, you know, embrace it and really give it my all and make him be beautiful in his dress. Like whether I felt he was deserving of those or not, if he was a real life person, it was to help tell that story of like, you know, how he kept all this finery for himself and how he presented himself in the world, even though he could be really, you know, you could just detest him. So I think, yeah, I think having compassion and empathy and then very like having a broad scope of what, how the character plays into things and how important it is for you to really embrace them and encompass them.
Something you told me actually on that job for Snow was, I don't know if you'll remember, but it's what you kind of just said, but you put it in a more specific way. When you were talking about trying to design Snow and thinking about like all of his dress and how beautiful the clothing could be and all of that stuff, it was when we were talking about him being like the villain, you were just like, well, villains in their own right, in their own head, don't think that they're bad. They believe what they're doing, right? So it's like his arrogance and his kind of like the way his quaffness and the way he presents himself is because he really does feel like he's doing the right thing, right? And that was something that then like the etiquette, like I felt like everything with him was designed with etiquette. Like it was very proper. And I remember thinking of that as like a highly conceptual thought process from you, which was like you thought about it in terms of like, okay, well, he doesn't think he's bad, or he thinks he believes in what he's doing. He has a methodology about the way he goes about things. And so you kind of showed that through clothing. And I remember learning a lot about that, specifically about character design in the thought process. Like, yeah, villains really do think that they are doing the right thing. They don't like walk around like, I'm evil, you know, they're just like, this is what I'm doing. So I thought that that was cool. Process. Let's talk about process. Let's shift a little bit. when you start to design, or when you're thinking about stuff, starting with the script or even just collaborating with your directors, what's the first thing that you feel like you have to kind of dive into?
I first dive into breaking down the script. You know, we all have script supervisors, which is an invaluable person on any project, that we all know this. It's a very, very difficult job. They do a proper breakdown for us, but I like to really break down the script myself and pull out any keynotes of like any character points, anything in the story that is letting me have an indication of, you know, the person's, you know, their economical status, where they live, what the weather is like, how many days it takes place over, anything that particularly stands out about the character first, and then about what my need is for the costumes. You know, when am I going to need multiples? What color palette I can use? You know, I kind of start there. And then I'll start doing tears, and loose illustrations for myself of like what I see and how I want the world, and try and work on color, and having a conversation early on with the director about that, and hopefully the DP as well. And then, you know, it's talking to the production designer so that my characters can fit into her world. So it is all this happy storytelling, because, you know, as much as I love, you know, I love design and I really love building the costumes as opposed to, you know, just doing the shopping on shows, I really now have moved into like, if I can build everything, I will. You know, I mean, I'm never going to try and build khakis or a t-shirt, because we know that you should never do that. But as far as the other, you know, the other things, yeah, I want to. But it is a lot of, you know, just having these dialogues, like I was saying, again, it's like, it is definitely a tribe of people that you have to consider. And, you know, the production designer is on so much earlier than I am. So I really want my characters to fit into this world. So it's this happy storytelling, and it's not my costume jumps out and my costume jumps out. Like, that's not satisfying to me. You know, I mean, if I want to do that kind of thing, that's, I lean more into like doing something editorially where it's like, you know, it is just about the fashion. But yeah, so I kind of start that way. And then I reach out to, you know, those kind of people and those heads of department to get an inspiration from them and see where their head is. And it's a lot of dialogue with the director, you know, and you have to have a lot of dialogue with the producers too. And, you know, I am somebody who, I am very involved. You know, sometimes that's great, and sometimes I'm sure my team thinks that's not great, you know, because I do like to know everything. I like to know, you know, all the budget, where we're at. I like to know who's coming onto the team. I like to know all the locations we're going to be in. I, you know, I go to every department every day and talk to everybody. So I am very, very hands-on. But yeah, my process kind of starts that way. It starts in the script and the breakdown of the script and looking for, you know, what I can bring to these characters, and then having dialogue with the director about how he sees these characters and who we're looking at for casting, because that's a very big thing as well. You know, it's of how we're visualizing this person in our minds. And, you know, I've worked on like on C, one of the characters was a shaman, and originally it was written for a man. And then we were really lucky that we got the actress Tantu to come in. And she, you know, she's a native woman. She's in Flower Moon now. And so it shifted in a way of like, it was, you know, this big female presence in the film. And it really shifted for me in a bit of like, you know, the headpieces that I wanted to make for her and what her clothing was like. So I do think a lot of it, you know, the casting plays a big role in a lot of how we see the characters. So that's kind of my process. And then, you know, I'm big on fabrics. I like to get in fabric swatches really early, and kind of that really inspires me a lot as I'm working with the illustrators, you know, so I'm big on textiles.
You talked about custom made and kind of how you want to make things. I think that that's a big testament to you in terms of like, I think a signature Trish thing is whenever you watch a project that you've been a part of, there is very much so a lot of made to order or custom design, meaning that you can tell it's not phoned in. It's not something that was bought. This is something that was designed specifically to be this way. How do you feel you're able to successfully kind of get a lot of that through? Because I know the process sometimes can be difficult. Like, how do you feel like you're able to kind of push those things through? Like little things, like I remember the big risk of like on Westworld making the red latex, you know, or the gloves and like the for the architects and stuff like that. It seems like you're able to get custom design through the process, where sometimes it can be kind of snuffed out or made more pedestrian. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it takes you know, it takes a lot of focus. We all know, you know, made to order can be difficult and also great. You have, and again, it goes back to having a great team of people. And I am very, I'm a little bit pushy. I have a lot of dialogue with the supervisors as to the whys. Here's why I need to make this. Here's, you know, and I do try and weigh out, like, if I can have this over here, I can give a little on that, you know, and it's the focus of which characters I do really feel that need to be made. You know, I try and not do it from a place of ego that, like, I'm going to design everything and make everything. And, you know, I really, there's just things that just logically make sense of, like, well, we're going to build this, you know, and a lot of projects I do work on, we need multiples. And, you know, in the way the world is now, as we've all seen working in this business, you know, my heart goes out to shoppers so often because, you know, to have to be out there in the world and find all the things that we need. And if we need multiples, it's really, really hard now. We don't have the quantities of things, you know, available to us anymore. And so, I mean, I think in that sense, it's like I try and be really focused on the pieces that I'm going to make and have all the information as to why I want to make them and how. And working with, you know, some of my illustrators on the last several projects, I have them all do flats as well, because I think that's really integral. And as you know, I told you, like, let's go to set so you can see, or let's go to the workroom so you can see what you're drawing, because it's really important, you know, to share information. I'm not somebody who withholds information. And I love for everybody who's working on the project to get to see the outcome of things. Because if you don't have your illustrators come into the workroom and see how things fall on a body and see where seams have to go and how do we hide these zippers, you know, that's a disservice. It helps everybody if everybody's informed of knowing how to be better at your craft and be better at your art. And so I think, you know, I put a lot of that into, like, made to order that, you know, I try and really work closely with the cutter fitters on, like, I really love this fabric. Will this work? You know, I feel it will work, but, like, do you feel it's going to work? How's it going to drape? And I try and do a lot of the draping myself to get an idea, you know, on like how it's going to look and what works and how colors read. And I take a lot of photos on my phone and I zoom. Somebody the other day was sent me to, they're like, you take these photos and you zoom in really tight. Yeah. And I said, well, I work with a couple of directors that are very, very, very technical, you know, and the types of cameras that they use and, you know, how high definition they see things. And so it makes a difference in that thing of, you know, of how the fabric is going to read and how color is going to read. And so I try and have that focus on when I want to make things, because I know how much it takes for everyone to get this made to order to happen, you know, and how many fittings I'll get with an actor. You know, that's something that I still struggle with production. They don't understand why, if I'm building a man's suit, do I have to have, you know, 3 and 4 fittings? And I'm like, 3 or 4 fittings is nothing, you know, to build a complete man's suit. So I do really try and pick and choose my battles with the things I really feel, you know, that are integral to be made and why I want to make them.
I think that just to a testament to what you were just talking about, the first working with you on Catching Fire, that was the first time I felt like I was actually involved, where, like, I was, that's the first time a designer has pulled me into things where I'm like, and I felt like I learned, because one thing as an artist, I've always said, you can't draw what you don't understand, right? So you can't translate something, like, it just doesn't come out of nowhere. You can't translate it unless you really understand it. So it was super helpful to be involved in things, or for you to show me things, or to, like, walk me through things. And I've seen you kind of do that with the rest of the department, even to the point where one of the stories that I tell that actually makes me laugh is, it was the first time that I was even really introduced to some of the actors or to some of the other key crew, where I remember being on the phone with my mom, and you brought in Josh Hutcherson, who played PETA, to come and meet me. And, like, he comes in and he says hi, and I'm on the phone. I was like, mom, I'll call you back. And he laughed. And I just remember it was such a funny interaction, because I just wasn't used to that, like, being a part of that. I'm used to kind of being in the background. So I appreciate that. But I also learned a lot by going to those things, or, like, reading the books you were reading, or, like, being involved in the process to see how it was all going to fit together. So I know that the rest of the crew also appreciates that. I think it's a lot of work on your end, too, to kind of bridge those things together. But I think that ultimately I hadn't considered that was a big part of why those things go through. Because especially being on movies where we see how the process comes together, you guys as an audience should know, it's an incredible amount of work to get especially custom things through the process. And that means it has to go to the directors, the producers. It's like, it could be a bold choice to get that to actually be the thing you see on screen is a skill. It's not easy. So I want you guys to know that, because I think that you can see things on screen, but you don't know how they got there. So thank you for that.
And sometimes we don't know how they got there.
Yeah, we don't know how they get there either. We're like, oh, that went through.
We're like, please, I hope it makes it. I hope it makes it. I hope it's ready in time. I hope it's ready in time. You know, yeah.
I want to talk about, well, first, before we go into this, the last question I had is, what has been something that's been a challenge, or what do you feel like has been one of the most challenging things that you felt like was rewarding at the end, like a challenging film or something that you felt like really pushed and challenged you?
Well, I mean, it's many things. I think each project kind of has their own challenges. You know, I have dialogues with some other costume designers that, we bring up. I'm like, is your project this hard? You know, is it everything just this hard? I don't know if it's time frame anymore or the expectations of studios of what, you know, somebody told me, they're like, well, you turn out, you know, you always make it, you turn out things on time and things look great. So they expect you to do it the next time, you know? I mean, I am somebody who really, I am very vocal. And I do stand up a lot for like my crew and what our department does and how valuable our department is. And luckily I work on a lot of projects that are very costume driven, you know, and I hope that, you know, our producers and the studios do see that, because, you know, it is, you know, how we bring up Naked Without Us. It's, you know, the last film I did, we can't really buy those clothes. You know, it's like they, it's very integral as to what we do. I mean, I think, you know, different projects have different struggles. I mean, you know, this last on Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, it was the time frame and the quantity of things we needed, you know, the amount of school academy uniforms that we needed, you know, the amount of background that we had to dress that kind of kept growing every day. Like we got, you know, we were told it was going to be 600 for the districts, and then for even just, it's just District 12. And, you know, and Joe Sigliano, who is a key background costumer that travels a lot with me, and he heads background with me, you know, I'm talking to him one day and we're up to 1600, you know, and so that's enormous, an enormous change. And that's, you know, trying to find enough clothing to fit all those people. And so I think those are kind of challenges, sometimes the scale of the project and having it done. And, you know, Corey Dice and Allie Egler, who worked on the same project with me, you know, their challenge of finding enough yardage of this red fabric to make all these red Academy costumes. You know, it's like that was very stressful for them. And it's the dye lots come in and they're all slightly different. And, you know, we're getting shipments shipped to, because we're working in Poland and Berlin. And there's the stress of the war with the Ukraine had just started. And so you want to be really, you know, you want to be very emotionally available to your crew and, you know, and how they're also dealing with that. So there's just different struggles with different projects. You know, on sea, we had a lot of sightless and visually impaired actors in that. And so it is talking through with them on, you know, how closures work on their clothes. And it was really like, that was a great learning curve for me. And I got really excited about that project for many, many reasons of just using so much recycled product. I mean, we would go to junkyards and, you know, I mean, we went to like, you know, the Sea Legacy place where you could go in the warehouse and, you know, buy all this, you know, ocean trash, and we make costumes out of that. And, you know, and so that was really, really great and challenging, but also learning from like, you know, this group of sight impaired actors and background of, you know, what they needed to dress themselves every day in these layers and layers and layers of costumes. You know,
I remember this, I don't want to cut you off, but I do remember a challenge for C, because I remember talking about it or talking with you about it through it. Which was, so Trish is high, we've talked about this, Trish is highly conceptual, right? So one of the things that was a challenge on C, do you remember this, was just thinking about color palette, because they can't see. So right. It's like color is not important to them. Now, granted, color is important to the audience because we're watching the show, but then if you're really mentally placing yourself in this world where you're designing clothing for people that can't see, color and pattern kind of doesn't matter. It's about so then it's like that. Do you remember that juxtaposition you were having where you're like, how far, which way do
I go? Yeah. Yeah. And it was that thing of like, you know, coming up with, you know, again, with flora and fauna of animals and colors that they would have. And then also, you know, like, you know me, like I'm not big on, I don't do fur. That's the first project I'd ever done fur on. So it was really important for me. I bought stuff from First Nation families and roadkill. It was amazing. We could use roadkill hides because it didn't matter if it had holes in it. And, you know, it was just way we can incorporate, you know, having to use fur without having to buy from furriers, you know, and that kind of way. But yeah, it was a great challenge, and, you know, had my mind working in a different way of like, we would rust fabric so I could get color from rust, and yep. We would use, you know, flowers and plants to dye the fabric. So in my head, it was for smell, for all the, you know, for the sight impaired people, that they could have this aroma and the smell, and how you could tell the different tribes, and you could see who was your tribe and who were your people. And it was incorporating smell. And with that, I can incorporate color, you know?
So let's talk about, because this is a good transition. Let's talk about Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, because we were talking about the work there. That's the last project that you just had come out, and the challenges of that. The key thing is that for this one, you got to establish characters from, established characters that we know now from the series, but we went back. So one of the first ones would be Snow. Let's talk about now kind of how you established him and kind of thought about like where, we obviously know where he ends up, but like, how did you start by establishing, like, you know, who he is as a young man?
With Snow, you know, Tom Blythe, who played Snow, who's, you know, was a really great actor and brought so much to this role, which were big, you know, there's some big shoes to fill in this film because of, you know, the fan base and the actors who, you know, played their older selves or, you know, led the front on the first films. With Snow, you know, we had to, it was interesting the way we shot, because, you know, we don't ever shoot anything in order, in story order. So Tom had to actually have his head shaved first. And then, you know, had to have these wigs made and wear wigs, you know, for the earlier parts of the film, because we shot out of order. But with him, I knew I wanted to have him, you know, it's that thing again, right? With this character where there has to be some innocence and purity about him at some point, so that you can see how this character grows and escalates into who he becomes much later, you know, 60 years later. So with him in the beginning, it was, you know, even down to like, you know, the Capitol uniforms, like the red Academy uniforms. I knew, yes, I wanted those to be red. When I saw from the production designer, Uli, when I saw where we were shooting and all these amazing locations in Germany that are very cold and stone and have these beautiful sculptures. And so I thought, okay, red is great here. And I just wanted the, you know, the students to be this sea, because I figure, you know, in my head, like, they're the youth. And so they're the blood of the Capitol, and it's flowing through all these buildings. And then with Tom, it was, you know, having him, he has to be dressed the same as everyone else. So how do we make him stand out? And so it is in his, you know, in his dad's shirt when he shows up for the reaping day, when he thinks he's winning this award, is making him again be very fitted, you know, very polished, even though we know they're struggling with money, and having, you know, him not have a jacket on so I can see the strength of his shoulders and this bright white shirt and, you know, the adornment of the buttons. So it was having him kind of stand out there and be really light in those kind of scenes. And then, you know, cutting to the end of the film, when he goes back to confront Highbottom, I kind of pulled in a look I did for Donald Sutherland in Catching Fire, in this really, you know, deep kind of Bordeaux coat, overcoat, and kind of mimicked that look, but on Tom, and made it much more youthful on him. And, you know, showing this progression of, you know, this innocence from when he's 17, 18, and to the end of our film, of how even within just this small amount of time, what he's had to see and what he's had to do has really hardened him and turned him into this man. And you can kind of see that transformation more into the Snow that we know from the other films.
It's such a weird transition too, because I didn't expect it, just having known so much about the films and working and all that stuff and dealing with Snow as an adult, that I liked him. Like, I actually liked him as a character, and I felt like he was the one that felt the most just, or he felt like he had the most morals out of the people in the Capitol. Like, and that was such a weird transition to also see, like, I was like, oh, that's how he got there, you know? Cause it's like, he didn't start there, but he ends up getting there and kind of what he's gone through. So I think that was cool. especially having to establish that. But I thought that that also could be a problem in trying to like figure it out. You brought up the academy uniforms, and I wanted to talk about those because they are very they stick out a lot in a good way. But also the choice of the blazer and then the kind of pleated skirt combination. Can you talk about that and like what your thought process was design wise?
Yeah, I think the thing with, you know, school uniforms, there's been so many school uniforms in films and in TV. And, you know, and I did Slumberland, which we also had school uniforms there that were much more youthful. And oddly, you know, we had to weave some of those skirts because of the transition of when she's in the real world and the dream world, you know, she's in the same clothes, but we changed the, you know, heightened the stripes and the colors. So I knew I wanted to do something different on this, and I wanted it to be very clean and very, you know, a bit communistic in a way, but very fashion in a way, because again, it's the youth. And I think the youth and, you know, Dr. Gall and Tigress in the film are the most kind of fashion forward. They're the most in touch with what the future is and where things can go. And so with the students, I wanted to also have a very androgynous look. I didn't want, you know, females or women or girls in skirts and men and boys and fellas in pants. Mm-hmm. I wanted everyone to be the same. And, you know, even though I've done some kind of, you know, really high fashion types of things before in the past, I always really love something about a classic item, something that's a timeless piece. And for me, a kilt is very timeless. And much in the way of like the corsets I put in the films, corsets are very timeless. You know, they've been around forever and we're still going to continue to see them in fashion. So it was important for me to figure out how to do this kilt and keep the pant a bit narrow in a classic shape. And then just keeping the jackets very clean. And, you know, so doing no lapel on them, because the lapels can fit quite differently over a woman's chest than on a man's.
Yeah.
And, you know, and keeping the collars very, very clean and not to distract from anything, you know, in the head and the face, because Frances does a lot of really tight shots. And so I didn't want to ever be distracted by a collar. And then the other thing, you know, besides the fashion and what I want the costumes to look like, I am of, you know, both minds where I have to talk about function as well. Yeah. And what's going to help us, because we had so many students and so many backgrounds. And so for the mentors, you know, we had so many mentors, male and female, and we don't get a lot of those actors till very last minute. So I knew I had to manufacture and make costumes prior to getting all these bodies and who were going to be cast. And so for function, it's much easier to alter a shirt that doesn't have a collar on it than it is to alter a shirt with a collar. And the same for a lapel on a jacket and how many buttons I wanted on the front and having welt pockets instead of flat pockets. So there was a few things that I did after designing that I thought, okay, let me take into consideration of the amount of work it's going to take for this design to work on so many bodies. So I just had to find that happy marriage between the two, you know, and feel really good about it. And then we move forward with it because, you know, if you're dressing, you know, 500 background in these uniforms, we need about 1500 uniforms to be able to pull all these sizes from, not to mention the amount of shoes. You know, nobody really thinks about how many shoes, but you know, you have to at least offer each actor or background, you know, 3 to 5 pairs of shoes to try on because everybody's foot is so different. Even if you're all a size 8, you know, it's like, it's all going to be different in how you feel in your shoe.
What were those days like where you had the most amount of extras? Like, what did you have to kind of like prepare or do? Like, what was that schedule like to get them into their uniforms dressed and ready to go?
That schedule was very tight. And you're also talking about, you know, we're still in COVID. So, you know, it's on the tail end of COVID, but we're still in COVID. And we did have, you know, we didn't have massive fallout with COVID, but we did have, you know, people getting COVID. So, you know, there was a bit of padding on how many people we'd have in case somebody did get sick. But, you know, we ran into some problems with the manufacturing of our school uniforms, where I had to bring in, you know, quite a few tailors to recut things. And so that really put us behind. And that was probably for me the most stressful thing. And my two assistants, Corey, who's my US assistant I've worked with several times, who's great and really, really focused and very driven and and you know, and is just, he cares a lot. And Rahel, who was my local German assistant, and then Susa, who was the local ACD for the background, and then Joe, who was also with us. And it was our group that was kind of really focused on all the uniforms and making them all work and all fit. And, you know, and besides the school uniforms, I mean, we had that, and that was, you know, a beast within itself. But then when you're talking about, say, our peacekeeper uniforms, and we're not getting the same actors every day, the background actors, to wear the same uniforms, because they're not carrying people, because that's a cost to carry the same actors and same stuntmen this whole time, we are constantly refitting uniforms on new people. And I think that was probably even harder than the red uniforms, though I do have a couple of tailors that say, you know, they no longer ever want to see the color red because they cut and rebuilt so many uniforms. But yeah, the challenge was definitely with the peacekeeper uniforms, of constantly having different actors put these uniforms on and us having to constantly refit them, and only having so many, you know, because of budgetary reasons, you only get to make so many.
Correct.
And you just have to keep repurposing them instead of allocating, like, Phil, this one's yours. If you ever come back, here's your uniform. You know, it's like, it's like, yeah, like four other people are going to take your uniform. So I've got to dry clean it. I got to clean it. And then I've got to re-alter it, you know? So those were big challenges.
Which that's going to be difficult, because you, it's a testament to all of you guys. You guys did a good job because you don't notice it, but the peacekeeper uniforms are very clean and very structured, and they fit a certain way. And that's something that I noticed when watching it, how clean they look. So it's crazy to know that while you're watching it, that same uniform could have been worn by three different people or whatever it is, and it's being tailored to fit, because that could have been a disaster. So that's an also a thing. Let's talk about that, because I did have a question about the uniforms. We're talking about the Academy and the Peacekeepers, but you had so many different factions, even just going to like District 12, and there was like a choice there. You had like blue denim and like utilitarian. Like, how did you separate all of these different groups of people, like in terms of like their looks?
Well, with, you know, I mean, it was kind of in the same sense, you know, with like, say, like, you know, the first film, Catching Fire, or with C even, you know, I had these different groupings of people. So I do kind of, you know, kind of go about it that way. I kind of look for what I want to bring up about each group or each tribe or each community or each neighborhood or each army. You know, it's giving them each, whether it's a color or a texture, to keep it individual and keep something special about each one of them. And this time around with District 12, I wanted to show the life of District 12, because in the movie in Catching Fire that I did, District 12 was mainly known as very, you know, kind of Dust Bowl, down and dirty, very coal mining aesthetic to it. And I feel like since we were so early from the other films, that maybe the Capitol didn't have as much control over them, such a tight control over them. And I really wanted to show District 12 had this life, and it was a vivacious community. And, you know, besides the coal mining that happens, they also have the hob where they sing and dance and they play music. And, you know, there's this color, and then they're very driven by heritage. And so there's a lot of beauty in the hills and in this lake, and they all fish and they grow their own food. So it was very important to me this time around to show color in District 12, and little details and embroidery and, like, you know, folk pieces, and show that, like, you know, that they are a very proud community. And, you know, when they have to show up with all the districts, when, you know, when the tributes have to go to these reapings, Francis and I always talk about, they're in their Sunday best, because yes. Because they're showing up proud, and they're showing up as a community, and they want you to know what district they're from, so that you have, like you're saying, this empathy and compassion for them as the Capitol audience watches them. So for me, it was very important to always put, even sometimes if it seemed a bit like hokey or, you know, homespun, like, you know, our two kids that are from the fishing district, they have hand painted fish on this, because that's what these young kids would do. That's how they would show, you know, who they are and like where they come from. And so for me, that was really important. And I tried to do that in the district. And then on the flip side of it, all the background in the Capitol, I felt, well, they're more contained. They're more controlled by the Capitol. So I didn't allow prints in there. I didn't want to see print and lots of, like, you know, lots of color like we had in the later film, where it's just, you know, very extreme and very over the top. So I just wanted to kind of flip that this time around, and not have, you know, not have everybody from the capital be colorful and vivacious and free of will. I wanted to see like, okay, they're more controlled this time around, and keep them in their solids and keep them like more, you know, just more controlled as a palette. So that's kind of where I went with it this time around.
Talk about, because you were talking about it, this is a perfect transition for this in terms of like the Sunday best. And like, let's talk about Lucy Gray and the first time that you see her as a character, how she's presented with her like corset and her skirt and all of that. Like, what was that choice about? And like, what were you thinking and how did you transition her throughout the piece?
Well, in the book and in the script, you know, especially in the book, we reference Suzanne, the author of the books and all the franchise. She references this rainbow dress often. And you know that it was her mother's rainbow dress. And I was reading the books, and when I read the script, I told Frances, I said, I like me wrapping my head around a rainbow dress. You know, it can go so many different ways. And at the time, and you know me, I'm not, even though I do color in films, I'm not like a lot of color together. It's like very, you know, separate the way I use color. And so we didn't have the actress cast yet. And, you know, there was a few people they were looking at, you know, whose timeline and schedule worked. And there's also, you know, singing involved. So there was a lot to casting this part. And, you know, and then on to whatever actress it was going to be. These, again, are very big shoes to fill because they're not Katniss Everdeen, right. But Katniss had such a big following. Jen had such a big following with all these films.
Yes.
So it was taking a lot of time to figure out who was this fit for this role. But I have to start designing before I can wait for casting, you know, because it's time is of the essence. And so with it, I did, you know, working with an illustrator and pulling in fabrics again, you know, just started doing illustrations, and they were kind of, you know, at first it was just, I wasn't feeling it. Like I would do some and I was like, that's not it. That's not it. That's not it. And then there was like two dresses that, you know, that I came up with that I thought, okay, I think because Frances really wanted to see something. So I sent them to him and I said, here's where I'm at right now. And there was one he really liked. And then, so I let that sit for a minute. And then I thought, you know what? It's not, I don't feel it in my gut. Like, I know that's not the dress. I'm not feeling it. I'm not like overcome and like, oh, this is the dress, you know? And so I put it aside for a minute and we were working on, you know, like Tigress's character and definitely the uniforms, all the uniforms we did, we started focusing there, pulling in those fabrics because of the quantity of that, we really had to get that going. And then I kind of came back to it and we had ordered in and looking for fabrics that we didn't have to dye every fabric a color to work for the rainbow dress. So we're like, okay, tulle's really great. Let's look at tulle. That has some stretch and give to it. Because I also, again, you know, want to design what I want to design that I feel is appropriate for the character and brings that character to life. But I also know, because I have the script of, and I've also done one of these films before, how much this dress is going to go through because she wears it for such a long period of time and through the games. So I had to really keep that in mind, or I could just be selfishly be like, that's my design and hand it off to the set people and turn my back, you know, and not worry about what happens to it. But I can't do that because I'm also on set a lot. So, you know, we started pulling in all these tools and that's what really was like, okay, because we could get such a range of colors and I wanted it to be muted because if it was indeed her mother's dress, you know, we're not talking about something that's these bright, bright colors. And I even said to Frances, I said, and who knows what a rainbow looks like then, you know, it's like, if we're in the future and the way, you know, the way the environment's going now, who really knows what the rainbow is going to look like and through the clouds and, you know, and so, so I kind of started with the fabrics. And when I started getting these fabrics, then I started drawing again with the illustrator. And I knew I wanted to have some tie-in to Katniss. And I knew I wanted to give respect to that, to Jen and all she brought to, you know, this character. And I also wanted to give this new actress, you know, just a little bit of footing to stand on, just giving her a little, like a little encouragement and a nod of like, Katniss is a part of you. It's the thing that I always refer to as like, you know, we've stood on the backs and shoulders of a lot of people to get where we're at. And you need to pay homage to those people. You know, I'm a big in respecting our elders, you know, and not our elderly, it's our elders. And Yeah. They've brought a lot to what we've done. And so it was kind of in that. And also I felt it would give this actress a little like, you know, encouragement of like, Katniss is with you on this. And as hokey as that may sound, that's like kind of where my mind goes. I like these backstories. I like giving actors things that encourage their performance or can help their performance in any way. So I wanted to do the corset. I wanted to mimic the corset that you and I had worked on, which was the blue Mockingjay dress, and take that silhouette and use that here. And also I felt, you know, with the background of where Lucy Gray's covey comes from, this is a very lineage kind of piece. It totally makes sense, you know? And then it was painting the Katniss and primrose flowers on it and with the snake so that we also had that tie in. And then, you know, doing the skirt and the layers of tulle so that it does have some play and give to it and the gradation of the colors there. And then the underlayers and giving her bloomers underneath so that with all the action, you know, she's always constantly covered. I had to consider all the stunt pads that have to go underneath all of this stuff. I have to consider her stunt person who's not the same size as Lucy Gray, as Rachel, and what she has to, you know, wear and put underneath. So it was a big thought process, but when I did, you know, I worked with Gloria Kim on the illustration of Lucy Gray, and when I settled on that, like I knew and I felt like this is it. And when I sent it to Francis, you know, because I told him on the other one, I said, that's not the dress. And he goes, no, but I really like this one. I said, it's not the dress. I know it's not the dress. And I felt really good about this design. And then it worked out really wonderful because, you know, Rachel is very petite and very tiny, you know, and so I think it didn't, you know, it didn't wear her, like she wore the dress. And that was also really important to me too. It can't look like a costume and it can be a performance piece. You know, she's part of this kind of vaudeville, you know, traveling musician troupe. So she does wear, you know, performance pieces on stage because she is the eye candy in this room. And so I felt like I needed to put something on her that lent itself, you know, in my mind of like all the musicians I've worked with in tour clothing. It's that, but it didn't wear her, you know, that she actually wore the costume.
It very much so to a testament to what you're talking about, which I noticed when I watched it was it's a second read. So this dress could have been garish. It could have been crazy, right? Like a rainbow, like in a design. I didn't notice the rainbow part of it or even the colors really until she was already up on stage, meaning she had done the whole thing. She bowed, she did all this stuff. And I noticed more of the corset. And I think that's probably there was a lot of medium shots, but the skirt was a second read, which I thought was really smart. It didn't stick out in a bad way, meaning that it wasn't like when I first saw her, you're like, whoa, rainbow. Like I didn't notice it at all. And then as it went along, you notice it in the action, but the colors are just muted enough to where it's a good design because it doesn't overpower. And like you said, she's wearing it, it's not wearing her. But that is something that I noticed. So I wanted to ask you that question. So I'm glad you talked about it because it was something that, if designed poorly, could have been really distracting. Or it's like, why out of this entire district, especially when you look at, if you pull back and look at the district that she's coming from and all of the people, she sticks out and it feels special, like she's wearing her Sunday best and she's going to represent the district, but it didn't stick out in a way to where you're like, how is she the only one that's kind of wearing this, right? It was a weird thing. It kind of worked. Which is something that also too, and talking about the bloomers and all of that stuff, I felt like it was the perfect balance for her. It kind of went with the fact that she sings and all of those things, but it carries through. So I thought that that was cool. The
And
other,
also,
oh, go ahead.
with her covey, you know, who are her bandmates, her
Yes.
covey, you know, they were dressed very much in a similar fashion too. And
Correct.
we shot a lot more scenes with them than what ended up in the film. But, you know, even their stage performance, it's, you know, they have their stage clothes. This is what they wear. And then you see them at the lake and they're just in overalls and
Yeah.
t-shirts, you know, so there's the difference.
You now got to go. I have to talk about this because these are some of my favorite. We must talk about Viola Davis
Yeah.
as a Dr. Gall.
Yeah.
Those are some of the stronger designs just by nature of who she is as a character and then the way she portrays her. Can you talk about that collaboration and how those costumes came about?
Yes, Dr. Gall. I mean, I was really very excited to get to work with Viola and watching, you know, the transformation that she does from character to character in every, you know, every film and TV series that she's been in. So that was really exciting for me. And her team, her hair and makeup team, Sergio and Tamika, are extremely lovely to work with. and are up for anything. And, you know, and again, I started the project so much before they did. They were kind of, you know, working, they had just finished, you know, Woman King and mm-hmm. the press junket on that. And so we didn't get Viola until I really think it was 3 days before she worked. And in her first week of shooting, she had 3 changes. So we had to build a lot of her pieces because all of her stuff is built. So we had to build her pieces to a fitting state before she arrived because I only had 3 days to do any alterations on them. So, you know, and again, it's like, I can't, when I start the project, you know, I'm on before hair and makeup and I can't design a character from the neck down. I have to have the head and, you know, and I oddly, you know, Frances had brought up, she's this very kind of, you know, Willy Wonka kind of character. And, you know, and in my head, it's like, okay, she's a bit of a mad scientist, you know, and I could draw on all that. And seeing what her lab was going to look like, and then what the auditorium was where she spoke and would teach and stuff. And I wanted to have her, you know, be again, like it's her and Tigress are the most visual in the film. Like they're the most fashion forward. Also, because where we see Tigress's character in the later films, I, you know, she has an atelier. And so I wanted her to be, you know, be very pulled together. But for Dr. Gall, it's because, you know, she is the scientist. So she is very forward thinking. So I knew with her costumes, I could make them be this kind of where you could see she would kind of lead into the Capitol as we knew it from the other films. That happened much later. But so with her, she was fantastic. I mean, she came in and, you know, I started doing the fittings on her. And the first one I think we did was the lab coat. And I didn't have it dipped at the time, the first time, because we just needed to get the fit and everything right. And it's in pieces, but we'd been dipping fabrics to see how they would take it. And, you know, I had an amazing patina team there. Like you can call it Adria Dyer's or patina team. This amazing gentleman, Jan, who has a beautiful team of artists that work with him. And I would go in and kind of present these ideas and say things I'd want. And he'd be like, okay. You know, and just never said no. He would just be like, you know, and so it was, you know, it was really great that I got to experiment in Dr. Gall's, like with the coloring of her jacket and how we did that, which was really tricky. And I had to have doubles, you know, so that was a hard match to do this red degradé kind of dyeing that happened. And then, you know, there's another costume that is on exhibit somewhere right now. I'm trying to find out where it is, but it's this black and yellow, that I just love this black and yellow print that we did. And I always wanted to do ruffs on her neck and keep her hands covered. And part of that was like in my head mentally, it was that, you know, she works with all these creatures and she's a scientist. So she probably has a bit of scarification on her hands and in her face. And you know, all her creatures didn't always love her and abide by her, you know, and probably lashed out at some point. And talking with Sergio and Tamiko, who did her hair and her makeup, in that design and what they would bring to that. And then I thought like, okay, well, we'll cover her because, you know, Viola is very young looking and she's much younger than what we wanted our Dr. Gall to be. So we needed to age her up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she was very fit. So we wanted to add a little weight to her and I didn't want to have to pad her. So I just tried to do it in the shapes and the silhouettes of her clothes. Yeah. And so that, you know, she just had looked much older and bigger than what Viola is in real life. And so, you know, keeping the ruffs help cover her neck because she should have had an older neck and she doesn't. She has amazing skin. So they had to do a lot of prosthetics and damaging her skin and then keeping her hands covered so you don't see that. And it also helped us then in processing time so that in the morning she only had to, you know, they only had to do the prosthetics on her face and her wig instead of having to do prosthetics on her hands and prosthetics on her throat. So it was, again, working with them of like what designs I wanted, but it also helped in saving, you know, time in the prosthetics of, you know, of processing her makeup in the morning. But yeah, her character was a lot of fun to dress. And, you know, she's just such a radiant being when you meet her and then to watch her transform into this, you know, this character, which again, she doesn't think she's evil. You know, she doesn't think she's bad. She's just this scientist and she has tunnel vision on what she needs and watching human behavior. And I'm watching human behavior and I'm watching you turn against each other, you know? So
she was so quirky. And I think that the way it's like the, like, and kind of delightful and kind of mad, but then also like, it's interesting because normally like the designs that you did, those designs are very bold, right? Like the ombre red, very bold, the latex glove, all of that bold choice, right? To get through, and the black and the yellow and all of that. What's interesting though, is that by the way, I felt like the marriage was perfect. The way she plays her versus the way you guys made her look, they go together in such a good way to where on anyone else, those costumes could be overstated, right? Like they could really push forward. But for her, it's like her presence almost held it all together. It's a weird kind of thing, but those kind of complemented each other to where it's like that bold red could have been a big choice on someone else. But then because of the way she kind of held herself, it understated it. And it's weird to say that, like it understated the costume back, and then it felt like a real person. But I thought that was a really cool kind of like design collaboration between the two of you, because of the way the costumes kind of stick forward, but also pull back. It's like this beautiful marriage. So good job there. It was really cool. I thought that was cool. We also have Tigress, who we know how she ends up as well. And then it's cool to see she's kind of the first kind of thought process you get in terms of like where the capital can go and kind of the fashion of everything. Can you talk about like that kind of collaboration and how you kind of hinted at that?
Yes, with Tigress, who is Hunter Schaefer, and I've said this in several interviews, who's just... I mean, a dream. She's just a dream. Just an incredible, kind human being. So yes, knowing, because I didn't do the Mockingjays, but seeing what the Tigress character is in the Mockingjays, and then what she is in the scripts, and how close she is to Snow and being his cousin. For me, Tigress in the film is kind of the heart. You know, she's this kind, compassionate being, no matter what's going on around her. Her moral code doesn't shift, whereas we see Snow's moral code really shift. And so I just really wanted to keep her, in a certain color palette so that your eye is drawn to her. But I wanted to be really, have when she's in the outside world, have her have these extremely structured shapes. And like you're saying, leading into we're seeing where the capital is going to go, that like where, we're eventually going to get to this catching fire where it's extreme fashion and over the top and so much color. So I wanted to have that with Tigress. And I also wanted it to be, in the movie we just did, she does work, with a designer in an atelier. It's not her own yet. And we do see in her bedroom, her fabrics and her sketching. And so I wanted to always make her be the one that, she's holding the family together. It's not just Snow. She's the one. She's making sure everybody's clothes are presentable. She's making sure that everyone looks, the most current that they can look, because they're all living this lie of that the family is all fine, and they're definitely not fine, and they have no money. So it's kind of this big burden on her and this responsibility on her that she keeps everyone together. So she is making their clothes and she's repurposing their clothes. So with her pieces, I did a very subtle little things, like with, sewing seams on the outside instead of all the seams on the inside. Ah. Things, all this fraying. So her really structured pink suit that she wears, to the ceremony, again, Jan, who came in and did all this airbrushing for me on all the seams. When I went in, I said, I want you just to, do a hot fuchsia airbrush on all the edges and the seams. So it looks like this fabric faded, that it used to be a much more bold color, but it's all faded, and she's repurposed it and had to let it out or take it in. And again, we had two of those, so he had to match those, and he did such a beautiful job on that. And then, with some of her other pieces, it is also, there's a chiffon top that has these flowers on it. It's bright fuchsia when she's in the hospital. It is all the edges of the flowers on this fabric are all frayed. So I tried to tie those little bits in of like, that her fabrics are fraying, but she's using them in a fashion way. So you don't realize that's what's happening to it. And then, it was when she's at home that her clothes are soft. Like she's in all these soft robes. She's in these soft, nightgowns and slips. And it's when she can relax and be her own self. But when she's outside in the world, it is this very prestigious woman that you're trying to look at and see, so that she is, the representation of the family at Snow's side, you know, because you see Grandmam, and my thing with Grandmam was Grandmam never leaves the house, but she will not hawk her jewelry. They have no food, but she's hawked all the jewelry she's going to hawk. And these are the pieces she's keeping, you know, and with her turbans, because she can't afford to go get her hair done anymore. So she wears turbans. So it was just trying to play with things like that, with that family of like how they're falsely presenting in the real world.
I loved that, especially because, you know, kind of where they end up, like Tigress ends up with like the genetic engineering and the body modification and all of that stuff, which is so interesting to see how her humble beginnings and like where she goes and how you kind of framed that. I think that was really interesting. There's two other characters that I want to talk about before we end, which was Flickerman, Mr. Flickerman, and Highbottom, because I think that Peter Dinklage, just in terms of an actor, I love him in terms of his like just his presence. Can you talk about how you like kind of like brought that out, like with his clothing? Because his clothing is very structured, but it gives him stature. Were there some tricks in there, or how did you do that?
With Highbottom, yeah. I mean, I look at that movie and look at, you know, the previous one I did. Like, we're so lucky with casts that are drawn to these characters. Like, in Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, we have an amazing cast. And so, you know, with Peter, it is the thing, like, you know, I'm a big personal fan as well, like the veil of his work. Mm-hmm. And you know, still The Station Agent's one of my favorite films. But wanting to do something a bit different with him, because he's had such a vast career and played so many different characters. And I really wanted to play into the fact of, you know, definitely his arrogance, and especially his arrogance with Snow and the students. And even though, you know, he can be fired at any time, it is this thing of he doesn't really care about the capital. And, you know, he, you know, he's an addict. He drinks, you know, morphling all the time. Yes. And so I wanted to lean into, like, my idea was like, you know, he's somebody who hangs out in an opium den.
Yeah.
So he's in these very luxurious pajamas. So he, you know, when he's in the two piece outfits, he's in, you know, velvet and brocade pajamas, and all these silk pajamas. And I kept him very uniformed, because I don't think he's somebody who picks out clothing to wear every day. It's just, you know, it's all hanging there. It's all very much the same. Another inspiration in a different way was Azadina Laya always wore Chinese pajamas. And I love that about him. I love that he was this intelligent, creative, amazing force that did these beautiful women's clothing of structure and everything. And he always wore this specific uniform. So I kind of drew from those two different things. And then when Highbottom is addressing the students and he has to give these big speeches or at ceremonies, I wanted him in a mix between like a judicial judge's robe and a cardinal's, you know, robe. And that's what he wears. And again, very, you know, very textural fabrics, but, you know, he only wears navies and blacks. That's all he wears. And, you know, and it's these two uniforms is what he wears. And that's all he wears in the whole film. And always giving him pockets where he can kind of stash his little bottles of morphling.
And then what about Flickerman? Because Flickerman... Yeah.
Yeah, and with Flickerman, you know, he's a big fan fave. You know, Jason Schwartzman was really great to work with. He came in a bit early, which was really nice, because he had, you know, so much to bring to that character, being, you know, a weatherman in the film, but, you know, wants to be he's an aspiring magician. And then he becomes kind of this talking head of the games. And so with him, you know, I started him off kind of simple and trying to keep everybody a bit like him, and also Highbottom, keeping him in these capital colorways. But with him, it was keeping him, you know, where he's very, you know, he definitely has a big ego, and he definitely has a lot of vanity to him. So keeping his suits very perfectly fitted, like, to me, his fit was really, really, really important. And again, had amazing tailors on this, some of the, you know, the tailors in Berlin that were just so beautiful and just so wonderful. And so keeping him conservative to begin with, but as he starts to get this fame, you know, he grows and he is really excited that everyone's watching him and he's presenting, and, you know, and then so kind of every time we saw him, it was a little bit more fancy and a little bit more decadent and a little bit more elaborate. And talking with both Sherry and Nikki, who were the hair and makeup heads on the film, you know, kind of having that a bit in his makeup that, you know, he does get a little contour. And then I, you know, I did these illustrations of him with this, you know, with this pompadour and it just slightly growing every change.
Every single time.
And I go, it's a subtle thing, you know, that the audience may not notice, but I love this idea that like his hair is coiffed just slightly bigger each time we see him. And then he has a little bit more sheen to him each time we see him. And, you know, and he, a lot of those lines are his ad-libs, which were fantastic. I mean, he was really, really lovely to work with. And in his costumes, in his suits, we built these really big, massive pockets on the inside, but he could access them from his outside external pockets so that he could put these scarves and coins. And at one point I was like, please don't put a real rabbit in there. You know, it's like, yeah, but he was really, really fantastic to work with and just, you know, embodied that character so boldly.
What was cool about that is that that's one of the changes that I noticed in terms of just watching the film through for an arc, which was his style choice or it feels the most organic to like, if you've ever tried to build your own wardrobe or like if you start pushing your own fashion, it felt exactly that way, which meant that he started out kind of more humble, tailored, and you know he has an ego, but his ego grows and so does his look. So you could see it being where he didn't start out as the Flickerman that we knew. He starts out as this guy that's like, I'm a host, he's more of a public figure, and then as he gets more known, it's like you said, that transition, that visual transition is noticeable. You may not pick up every single detail of it, but the coolest part is that you can see him getting a little bit more bold, a little bit more ego. And then by the time he gets to it, it's like, okay, now I'm going to wear this crazy print or whatever it is. But he didn't start there. So I appreciated that because I thought it was kind of cool. Tell me about, we've talked a lot about the film itself, but I wanted you to talk about, you did a line inspired by the film with Lionsgate. Please tell us about that and talk about the pieces and where we can find them.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I did a line, and it was, you know, I've done this kind of marketing tie-in before. And this time for me, what I felt was really important was, you know, number one is showing kind of how valid costume designers are in merchandise for projects, because, you know, we keep our projects very close to our chest and in our hearts, and we know these characters inside and out. And we, but this film as well, it's like I really wanted to do something fan driven because our fan base is massive and they, you know, they've watched all these films, have read all these books. So I wanted to keep it very kind of simple pieces that the fans could identify with. And I also didn't want to do giant logos and thing. I wanted to keep it kind of subtle so that if you are a fan, but you're not into having the, you know, the giant bird on your chest, the Mockingjay, whatever, on your chest, that you would still find pieces in this collection that you would like. So we did t-shirts and hoodies, joggers, and then did a little bit of home stuff. Like, you know, we did a couple pillows, some blankets, you know, and like a scarf. And so it was just kind of something for everyone. And within those, the apparel articles, I wanted to keep the logo very subtle. I'll show you on
yes,
one of
please.
The-
show us some examples.
Oh, I just... the lights went up. I did that.
Okay.
so like on one of them, you know, it's like I wanted to do this hoodie that down the sleeves, we kind of have these iridescent snakes that tie into the snakes in Dr. Gall's lab. And so, you know, then also just doing the logo in a black on black. So it's not something bold. It's just, you know, more like subtle pieces that we did. And then doing like, let's see. Like, you know, like incorporating, this is one of the pillows, like incorporating the logo and the bird here, you know, but doing it in a more of a subtle way where there's, you know, we can incorporate the art. And I just tried to keep the whole thing very along the lines of roses, snakes, you know, it was like the roses for Snow, the snakes, you know, with Lucy Gray, and then the bird, because the bird has gone through all the films, you know, like this is one of the scarves we did, which, you know, the color came out really beautiful. Gloria Kim worked with me on, you know, all the illustrations and the artwork and the design. So I'm really grateful to her for that. And then we did a little bit of jewelry, which I'll show you. This, I think, is really talking about Peter Dinklage and his Morphling. We did this, you know, the charm bracelet,
yeah,
where there's a little vial of Morphling, you know, it's the 10th Hunger Games and it's the 10-year anniversary. So I kind of did a little nod to that. and then just the logos from the Capitol and the Academy. And then we did a charm bracelet for District 12 for Lucy Gray, you know, that has the District 12 symbol, you know, the logo for the film, and then the songbird and her little guitar. And, you know, and just kind of pieces, like our price range is nothing's over $100. We started off at, like, we have keychains that are $12 and on up, because I just wanted to keep it very fan driven. We, you know, we did this bracelet that's like one of the bracelets that Lucy Gray wears in the film. And then a little, also this little snake ring, you know.
Cool.
So just very kind of, again, very classic pieces. Like the same thing with, I feel charm bracelets are a very classic item. You know, they've been around forever. Every culture kind of has something that's their interpretation of a charm bracelet. So yeah, it, we did that. I did the jewelry line I did with this jewelry designer in Mexico. Her name's Laura Cantu. And so all the jewelry can be found on Laura Cantu on her site. So it's Laura Cantu Jewelry. And then all the articles of clothing and the home pieces, that's all on Lionsgate Shop. So it's at lionsgateshop.com. So they're just in those two areas. And yeah, and I hope the fans really like it. It's been nice because I've asked, you know, for the fans to kind of send me, if you buy something, let me see how you style it. Let me see how you wear it. And so that's always nice, because I do like looking at also the fan art that they do for the film. And so, yeah, it's nice to see how people, again, interpret their own pieces into their own style, you know.
I think you're missing one too. Are you wearing the dog tag?
Yeah, there we go. I love dog tags.
Yes.
Just different cultures. So yeah, we did a dog tag. And then on the back, it has, you know, the paraphrase, everyone hungers for something.
Awesome.
But yeah, so they came out great, and it's all offered in gold and in silver tones. So yeah.
So what I want to talk to our audience about in terms of advocating for designers being a part of this process is, you can see some of the stuff that Trish just showed. There is a difference, and why I think designers should be a part of this process is, there's a difference between kind of marketing and just placing logos on things or placing iconography on things and design. Right. So what you're seeing here is actual design. It's like, this should be here. It should be placed this way. It should be subtle. Designers think in a different way. So it's not just about like, okay, I'm designing for a sports team. Let me just put the Dallas Cowboys logo on everything. Like, that's like ad nauseum. That's a form of design in terms of like for everyone. But if you're thinking about designing something that's custom, what Trish has done here is actually taken things that are really meaningful from the film and put them into a design that actually people would want to grab or want to hold on to. The key thing there too is also, it is smart to involve the designer, because they literally just sat with it for however long, right? Like, it's a part of who they are. So I think it's a easier, it's a much smarter way to market things. And I'm glad that they allowed this to happen, because of the fact that it has the greatest chance of reaching the audience in a more meaningful way. Because it's someone that actually has designed and sat with it and been a part of the material, and not just someone that at the end of it is taking bits and pieces of it and just like throwing it on a shirt or something, right? Like, so I appreciate that. Can you talk just a little bit about, in passing, because you have done those kind of lines before, what that process means to you in terms of design and why it's so important to have a designer as a part of that?
I mean, it is really important. I mean, I have been, I think, very fortunate. You know, I did the two other projects that I did, which were more fashion-based, instead of just, you know, instead of merchandise that's accessible in this way. And that's why this kind of interested me too, because I've never just kind of done, we did t-shirts with, you know, we did t-shirts before in each one of the lines, but I didn't do just kind of t-shirts to market for the film like I'm doing for this. But I think it, like what you're saying, it's really important, because, you know, to have the costume designer be a part of it, you know, I bring up all the time, and, you know, we see the general public a lot make their own costumes from films and television series that we do. And we see them kind of come up with their own ideas at, like, you know, at Comic-Con. I'm fascinated with the fans come up with and how much they attach themselves to different parts of the film. And so costumes is always a very prominent thing in film and TV. And so, you know, when these studios want to go about doing marketing, it is very advantageous to have the costume designer be a part of that, because we do relate to the fan base and understand what that is. We do know who our demographic is and who's watching these films. And we do know what pieces, you know, every now and then you have a surprise of like what takes off, what somebody identifies with or which character. But generally, as you're making these projects, you do know this is going to be something that people really identify with or like, or this character is going to be that. And so like, it's even the simple things, but the charm bracelets, it's thinking of like, I want it to be a charm bracelet and here's the charms I want. And here's why. It's not just, let's just put the logo on everything. You know, I mean, like on one of the t-shirts that I did, you know, I brought up the fact about like, we don't have to have the logo on everything. And so, you know, even like with this t-shirt, it's based on like the roses, but it's on the back. So the logo is incorporated into the design. So it's not so bold, but if you are the fan and want to see that, it is there, you know, and how I wanted to incorporate, you know, the design of Lucy Gray's corset into the pillows, into some of the t-shirts. So I have those Katniss flowers and the primrose flowers and the snakes, because that is part of that character in the film. So I think that's what I really have to speak to, is that is we do know who our demographic is, and we do know what items, you know, will sell or will, you know, that the consumer can identify with. And also, since I do have, you know, a background in fashion design, and I've done a couple of these before, I am very hands-on about what the design should be, what the quality should be. That was a big conversation of, you know, I really want the t-shirts and the sweatshirts to feel really good. You know, it might be cost a little bit more. Let's try and stay in this perimeter, you know, so that the fans, it's accessible and affordable to fans, but also what the quality is. You know, I want the quality to be pieces that last, because, you know, we look at, like, you know, we have an exhibit at MGM in Las Vegas that's the entire Hunger Games exhibit. It's been there for 6-7 years, I think, now. So, and people are still going to see it. So I wanted the articles in that way to be something also that lasts and had some longevity and not just fast fashion, you know.
I really appreciate that. And I hope the audience really understands, especially people that have the power also to just even green light this collaboration or this type of thing. The studios need to be aware that you do have a built-in resource within your costume designer. It just makes sense to carry that process all the way through. And also, I think it's more financially fruitful. I think that if we did research and we actually looked at what sells, I think that whether or not you're doing the fast fashion thing or not, I think that design is something that's palpable. People don't maybe notice it on a day-to-day basis, but it's like when you go to the grocery store, what made you pick up that one bottle over the other one, right? It's design, right? So one of the things that I want to advocate, especially for my fellow designers, is the fact that you can have an idea. Everyone's got a bunch of ideas, right? And you can give that idea to 10 different people and they'll all translate it different. But the power is in the design. The design is the thing that actually makes people pull things up, pick them up, sit with them, feel them. And so I think it's really important to know that, why would you start that process with an entirely different group or a entirely different outside entity that's not attached to that thing, when you already have someone that's there that really knows it? So that's my spiel. That's my pontification on that part. But I'm very happy to be able to advocate for that, because it obviously shows in the work that you've done.
Well, and speaking to that, it's the same thing. Like, you know, when I, you know, was broached with Lionsgate about doing this, and there was a couple of things that came up that, you know, I was like, I don't align with that. You know, I like different, you know, whether it's different stores they want to work with or different ideas they have, I had to talk about what I felt I could align with and what I could bring to the table. And that might not be right for every studio, but I said, this is what I'd like to do. If we're going to do t-shirts and this type of thing, this is what I'd like to do. And in the same way, I said, I want to work with my illustrator from the film, you know, Gloria Kim, because she also knows this film. And so then I didn't have to retranslate of like, these are Katniss flowers, this is what it looks like, this is how they should be done, these are how the roses should be done. And, you know, and we've worked together on a few projects, and she knows my aesthetic and what's important to me, and we work well together. So it's in that same thing of, you know, you have to really understand who's right for the job, you know. And I think at times that's what I'm trying to make studios understand, is like, you may have this team of marketing people, but it doesn't necessarily mean they're right for these items you want to market. And if you don't have the costume designer tied in, it would be the same thing if there was a makeup line. Well, let's consult, with the makeup artist who did the film. You know, it's like, I think it's very much that you have to respectfully include the people that made it a success, you
Correct.
know?
I agree. And I will leave it there because I think that that's a good place to have it. I agree. I completely agree. So I hope more people are able to see this. Thank you, Trish, so much for your time.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Phil. Always a pleasure.
Same
Thank you
here.
for having me.
Before I leave you, I wanted to, where can people follow you on social media or where can they find you?
I'm on Instagram at Ms. T Somerville, so you can follow me there. You know, and that's kind of my only social media I do, you know.
That's completely fine.
Yeah, follow me there. Yeah, check out the apparel line and the jewelry line at lionsgateshop.com and lauracantujewelry.com. And yeah, and hopefully everyone has seen the film. You know, there's a lot of really special things in the film. A lot of really special actors, just really, really great cast. And yeah, and just continue seeing movies. Just keep going. See, I want everybody to keep going, see movies, see them when they're in the theater when you can, and read.
That's a big one. I think sometimes students will ask me like, what's a secret or what's something you do? And I'm like, I go to the library and they're like, the library, like it's like a
What
shock.
is this thing you speak
What
of?
is this library? So I'd
Yeah.
say yes, advocating for reading and then also just going and watching films, really supporting things. I think that that's going to be a key thing, especially with us moving forward in this industry, as people supporting the stories they
Yeah.
want.
I think so too, because it is the thing of, you know, yeah, it's sharing stories. I think that's a big part of what I was saying, like I like about filmmaking and TV. It's like, you know, I you we We can't all be all over the world. We all don't have the opportunity to always travel, but if you can see other people's experiences, you know, it makes it make it's about humanity in that way, you know, that you can share other people's experiences or have a glimmer into someone else's life, the great part of it and the sorrowful part of it, you know. So yeah, I just want our industry to keep growing, and I'm really excited about this year to come, because I think this year we've had a lot of great films. Looking at, you know, what we've had in this last year, a very diverse types of films, a lot of European films and films from all over the world, and just really great storytelling this year. This last year was really nice, really nice.
I agree. And with that, we are out of time. I want to say thank you again to our sponsor, Eastern Costume. I also want to thank Trish for showing up and giving us her time. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. I want to give a special thanks to founder, CEO, executive producer, Martika Ibarra, co-founder, costume designer, Marilyn Vance, and John Campia. And thank you to all our viewers for tuning in. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, tune into the audio version, wherever you can listen to your podcast, and you can follow me, your host, Phil Boutte, at Phil_Boutte. Yes, it's Boutte. If it's not Boutte, and if it's not funny, you're not saying it right. So Phil_Boutte on Instagram. And thank you guys so much, and we'll see you again. Bye,
Thanks,
everybody.
everyone. Thanks, Phil. Love you.
Love you
Thank
too.
you. Bye.